we'll go ahead and get started. I'm expecting both Gary and Eugene to hopefully join us in short order. Just to weigh in a few business matters before I turn the time over to Mr. Henstreet for budget overview of the budget and development process. When we start off as when the board starts off, we take the pictures as you can see out and display both as a corporate body and then individuals. We're arranging to have that done at 8 a.m. On the 3rd. So if you can be sure to be here an hour before when the meeting starts, we'll take care of all of that. We'll have to have one shots done here in the boardroom. And then let's see. On January 9th at 5:30 p.m., you're welcome to join me at One Loudoun Center. As you may be aware, we have an application from One Loudoun regarding a comprehensive sign package. The board dealt with this at its this board dealt with it at its final public hearing meeting this past week, and one of the items that for discussion are two proposed electronic signs that they want to do, one on off of Route 7 and the other off of Loudoun County Parkway. They are going to bring the gentleman who constructs these signs. He will have a display sign on his truck to bring out that we can observe at night to actually see what the impact is. And since this new board will have to make the decision on this case because no decision was made at the public hearing, it would be great if you can join us and to make that observation of this and make the decision when we take it up, which I believe we will schedule to come forward to the board on the 17th. The 9th at 5:30. No, out at One Loudoun. We'll do it on site. And what I'll do is arrange with them. We'll probably do it on a side street just off of Loudoun County Parkway so everybody can park and safely observe. Then on February 7th is our typical public hearing evening, and the public hearing will start up at 6. We do need to schedule the budget presentation by Mr. Henstreet. And looking at the schedule, we thought that it would probably be most convenient if we just go ahead and do that briefing at 5 o'clock, an hour prior to the public hearing, so we don't have to bring you in another day to make that presentation. And if there's no objections, we will go forward with that. And then, yeah, February 7th at 5 p.m. will be the budget presentation. And then the last thing, typically the way the board has operated sometimes on tasking staff to do certain items, generally, well, we want to get consensus of the board. And as we have discussed offline many a times, there has been concerns expressed about the volunteer sign patrol folks, we'll just say. And I would like to revisit that issue and kind of dissolve the volunteer portion of that. And if there is no objection, I'm asking Mr. Henstreet to put an item together for the board to come forward on January 17th, the second business meeting. No objection, so we'll go ahead and move forward with that. All right, that's it. Are there any questions on those? Seeing none, then I will just go ahead and turn the time over to Mr. Henstreet. And Gary, welcome. If you need dinner, there are some sandwiches back there. Feel free to grab them, come out and eat as you listen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess we've been asked to try to keep this to an hour, with including the presentation and all of the questions. So we will try to go through this very quickly. Having said that, do you want us to go through the entire presentation and then open to questions, Mr. Chairman, or do you want us to have the board ask questions as we go?
We'll just have the board ask questions as we go.
Okay, sir.
Hopefully we'll be able to keep them to a minimum because this won't be the only time we deal with this topic.
Some introductions for people that most of you probably have already met. The budget is split into two different areas, the capital budget and the operating budget. We'll talk about that a little bit tonight, and then you'll dive into that quite a bit sometime after February the 7th. But the staffs that oversee those two sections of the budget are here tonight. To my right is the operating budget staff, which includes Chief Financial Officer Mark Adams, Deputy CFO Ben Mays, and then the budget officer Mark Lozier. And then Robin Geiger is going to help us all with the presentation tonight from Public Affairs and Communications. To my left, or actually on the left side of the chairman, is the capital budget staff, which is headed up by Lewis Rao, who's the director of capital construction and waste management, and then Paul Brown, who is the division manager over the area, and then Dan Sismar, who deals a lot with the capital budget itself, as well as a lot, we do a lot with proffers and zoning and those kinds of elements, and so Dan helps with that as well. Very quickly, the topics that we're going to talk about tonight are up on the screen, and we've also provided you a copy of the PowerPoint presentation. We'll talk about fiscal and operational health. The reason for that is when we present the budget to you and we present the budget proposal, it is governed by an overall concept to try to remain fiscally healthy and also being able to provide for the operations that the county Board of Supervisors has determined that you want to provide. There are also several adopted fiscal policies which are combined into a adopted fiscal policy that governs both operating and capital budget strategies, including debt. There are fund balance policies, which are essentially funds that are left over at the end of the year as to what we will recommend those funds be utilized for, as well as and present those options to you for your consideration. We'll also report on tonight the status of the FY11 fund balance, which we received direction from the sitting board regarding what to do with the FY11 fund balance. We'll provide you an update on your fiscal situation for FY12, talk briefly about county operating functions, and then provide you both an update on the FY13 budget process as well as the capital improvement plan. Just a couple remarks as we get started. Coming into fiscal year 2013, we're coming out of a number of years where the county has gone through probably one of the worst economic downturns since the 1930s. So some of the history that you'll see that is contained within the budget document, certainly the adopted budget book that we gave you on November 19th, as well as some of the historical information that you'll see tonight, will show how the county has dealt with the overall county budget during the last 4 years, which is where the brunt of that national recession hit the county or impacted the county's overall budget. Throughout that time period, we have been able to maintain a AAA credit rating. We have been able to, at the same time, expand a lot of the core services to address a growing population or address the demands of a growing population, primarily evidenced in the school system where the schools have continually had to add or make accommodations to add roughly 3,000 students every year, additional students every year. And then over the last 4 years, we have continued to streamline county government operations. Some of the actions that have been taken in previous years include hiring freezes or hiring slowdowns, a monthly, which then went to a quarterly monitoring by the Board of Supervisors, primarily the Finance Committee, of all of the revenues that are collected by the board as well as expenditures. We also halted certain projects within the CIP in order to slow down the debt cycle as well as control when certain operating impacts took place or were going to take place. And then there have also been reductions in overall services provided to county residents due to just the reduction of staff and programming. Just a reminder, which this is a slide that was shown to you at one of your previous events or orientation discussions, Loudoun County continues to grow. We continue to add population, and which typically has meant for the county staff that we continue to have additional people coming to our door to request services, whatever those services are. And they range from public safety to mental health to parks and rec to libraries to those kinds of services, building and development and planning and development. School enrollment, which is exhibited in this chart, has continued to grow since what's in this chart is 2005 and is projected through FY18. The school system in that 12-year period or 13-year period will have gone from, or 11-year period, I guess. I can't see the numbers, but it's gone from about 45,000 people or to over 70,000 people. So that's a considerable increase in student population, which has had to have been addressed during the last two boards, and in a large part will have to continue to be addressed by this board as you go through your term. Even though the county's population and demand for services have continually been rising, dating back to 1998, the ratio of county staff to overall population has remained relatively consistent. We continue to try to right-size our organization as needs arise and as the financial situation presents itself, which is essentially the ability to pay for service. Some of that is done by combining different operations, by streamlining staff into similar-like functions. In some cases, it's the addition of new technology to take over what used to be a human function. It also includes things like contracting out for services where the private sector provides an alternative that can be done in a more cost-efficient manner. Throughout that time, we have also continued to combine and look at the organization overall. And that's some of the strategies that have been used to maintain a consistent numbers of staff to population ratio. This chart just shows very quickly kind of where local tax dollars go to and how they're allocated. And I think this is the total budget, the entire $1.6 billion budget, which includes capital. Of that, roughly 55% of the budget goes to just the school operating budget. Another 13.3% of your local tax effort goes to schools' debt service. About 25% of each tax dollar goes to support county operations, and then the remainder is 5% for county capital, and then there's a small amount for special funds and tax districts. As I started to discuss, when we look at the budget document and we look at trying to present something or prepare something for the Board of Supervisors to consider, we are guided by a board-adopted fiscal policy. I'm going to ask Mark or Ben if you can run through these fiscal policies. They have been in place since what's shown here is since 1984. They have been revised from time to time by different boards, but these set of policies that Ben is going to go through, which is also contained in your budget document, is really a large reason as to why the county has been able to maintain a AAA bond rating and has also been widely recognized by the rating agencies as well as many of your peers as being a fiscally conservative and fiscally responsible county. And a lot of that has to do with these policies that have been adopted by the board. So, Ben?
Sure. Good evening. As Mr. Hemstreet said, the board adopted fiscal policies were first adopted back in 1984. At the time, they examined the best practices of other jurisdictions around the country, especially we were only about a rated community at that point in time, and they looked at AAA communities to see what they should aspire to. Over a period of years, they have been updated probably about every other year. We did a substantial rewrite, 5 years ago, to make sure everything still agreed with itself. There are budgetary components, revenue components, management components, expenditure components, CIP, debt, and then there's a long policy on special assessment districts, which includes community development authorities. As we collectively examine the proposed Kincora Community Development Authority in the early spring, late winter, that will come into play because that's the set of documents that we're using to guide that particular practice. They're important for a variety of reasons, as Mr. Hemstreet said, especially to the rating agencies and the financial markets. First, having policies they consider to be a real plus. Second, having policies that make sense appear to, you know, are a real plus to them. And the fact that they make sense comes from the fact that they've been vetted through, you know, other best practices and our financial advisors. They're never entered into lightly. But the third most important reason why they're important to the rating agencies and to the financial markets is that they're your policies. They're the Board of Supervisors' policies. And if you adhere to those policies, that's an important point in our favor. It's when, you know, if you don't adhere to their policies, it's actually kind of worse than not having any policies at all, if that makes any sense. Again, you know, it helps plan the long-term financial planning. In our case of Loudoun County, because growth has been such a huge part of our life for the last, you know, 30-some years, our financial policies link very closely with many of our land use policies, and there are cross-references with the general plan throughout it. In terms of budget and debt, et cetera, there are policies that talk about no funding of current operations with borrowed funds. That's very important. No New York City kind of situation back in the 70s for any of us who are old enough to remember where they were borrowing money just to, you know, make next week's payroll. One of the more important policies is to fund not less than 10% of the total capital improvement program with local tax funding. We also have six direct debt capacity guidelines, which you'll see on the following pages. There are four of them are set as ratios and two are set as absolute limits. Again, the county has had other debt policies that we were, you know, frankly, we were in violation of. And about 10 years ago, the Board of Supervisors said, why have a policy we're going to be in violation of? These are the ones that we're using now with the advice of our financial advisors and with talking to the financial markets in New York. You have debt to per capita income, total amount of debt outstanding versus the total amount of income, frankly, in the community. As measured by the federal government, and our ratio is 8%. You see, we've managed to maintain under somewhere around 7% over the proposed CIP, the adopted CIP. Debt service to expenditures. This has been a very important one for us over the last few years, and will almost certainly be again as we examine the CIP next year. The policy is to keep debt service no more than 10% of total governmental expenditures. And that's a difficult policy for a fast-growing jurisdiction to adhere to. And as you see, we're right at the limits of that. There's a reason we're right at the limits. We've got a lot of needs/desires out there that people are looking to finance, both schools, general government, and transportation. And Paul and them will talk about that in a little while. The most important ratio, really, in many ways, is the debt to total property value. Because at the end of the day, in Loudoun County, you're going to be repaying your debt with real and personal property taxes. And debt service, that limit is 3%. Even under the scenario that's currently adopted, you're still a little over 2% on that. And then the fourth one is the 10-year debt payout. Of the outstanding debt that you have right now, how much of it will be paid off within 10 years? And you see where we maintain, very strong ratio on that. We want to stay over 60%. We're currently at about 71%, with that declining some over a period of time. When we issue our debt, we don't issue it like you would your mortgage, where we have an equal payment every year for the next 20 years. We actually pay off an equal amount of the principal every year. So if we're issuing 20 years worth of bonds, we retire 5% of the principal every year. For those parts of our debt, say a high school, might have, they're not really $100 million yet, but let's say it's $100 million. $30 million of that might be furniture, fixtures, and equipment. We will retire that portion over 7 years because we match the useful life of the asset that we're financing to the amount of time that it's that the debt will be issued for. That again is within what our is called for in our fiscal policies. 20. I mean, and really, you know, you use a school building generally for about 50. After about 20, you begin to have some real, you know, renovations, capital asset preservation issues. I'll talk about some of those again later, and you know, but so we go with 20 years on that. Although there are, you know, the board has looked at the past about accelerating that in some periods, extending it in others, but we've stated about 20 years. So we also have two limits. One is the annual debt issuance limit. There was a period of time when assessments in particular were growing so rapidly and incomes were also growing fairly rapidly that there was a lot more debt capacity available under some of the other ratios. But the Board of Supervisors at that time said, you know, they were a little leery about what the long-term future was like. So they put in place an annual debt issuance limit of $200 million a year. And as you can see, again, over the adopted CIP, we're not in any grave danger of violating that. Finally, the last one is the affordability index limits. About 10 or 12 years ago, the Board of Supervisors was looking for a way of weighting the different debt ratios that we had at that period of time to look at an overall ability to have an overall debt capacity number. And that's what the affordability index is. And there's a number in your budget document that will state what the current amount is per year. And again, we're staying under that fairly substantially. That, you know, there, as I said, there are other debt, there are other fiscal policies that also reference back and forth with what, you know, with the treasurer's investment policies and other issues that we have in the county.
It is important to note those last six ratios, or last four ratios and limits that we just discussed are heavily used when we build the CIP. So when working with the finance committee and then with the full board, when we get recommendations to look at the CIP and start considering what projects and what can be fit into the CIP, we make sure we match up with all these ratios and all these measures before a CIP is recommended. A lot of times we'll get a lot of requests to run multiple scenarios, and for us staff-wise, it's a very long process to run multiple scenarios because I think it's like 200 or 300 different spreadsheets we've got to connect to make it work. So we do put a lot of effort into the CIP, so when we get a CIP, when it's recommended, it will match up with these ratios. The next section really is fund balance discussion. And really, it's always a goal.
Well, fund balance is also covered by a series of fiscal policies. And, you know, I'd like Mark to talk about that. I just want to introduce it. You know, one of the things that we try to do is to present to you on the operating side a budget that is structurally balanced, meaning that we have matched ongoing or recurring expenditures to ongoing and recurring revenues. Because of the way that we budget, that almost we inevitably result in a year-end fund balance because we also don't want departments to overexpend their budget, so they will usually underexpend their budget. We also try to reserve a certain amount. There is a policy, a specific policy, that talks about reserving a certain amount of fund balance, which in our case is 10% of total revenues. That is set aside. We kind of refer to it as a rainy day fund. That is there for the specific purpose of dealing with a severe emergency or significant economic downturn, which could potentially keep us from finishing the current year. You know, maybe revenues didn't come in the way that we had projected them at the beginning of the year. But that's kind of the backdrop. So there is a set of policies that deal also with fund balance that weigh into our budget decisions. You know, the previous set of fiscal policies dealt primarily with debt and how we borrow money, and under the circumstances that we will recommend to you that money be borrowed and debt be incurred. So that set of policies just spoke to the limits within which we'll provide you a recommendation or a proposal. Fund balance is part of your operating budget, and those rules, which Mark will run through, really deal with what your cushion is in any given operating year, or any single year, because, you know, like I said, we strive to give you a structurally balanced budget. Recurring expenditures and recurring revenues equal each other. But Mark, if you want to, or Ben.
Sure. Yeah.
Can we get visibility into what the current debt policies are? It's not in this packet, but those.
Sure. The fiscal policies are in the executive summary of your first volume of your budget document. That they're pages E45 through, like I said, it's a lot of pages. E58.
In the larger.
In the volume one. Sorry. And. We'll be glad to talk about them with you ad nauseum if you'd like it. On a one-on-one basis, I think probably no one else wants to hear the discussion, but at least at first. Yes, we published this in both the proposed and the adopted document because they continue to guide how we try to do business. You know. In terms of fund balance, again, you know, the biggest single budgetary policy regarding it is to try to limit its use to non-recurring, the use of fund balance to non-recurring expenditure items. You know, again, in a county budget of $350 to $400 million just for the county side, and substantially more than that for the school side, there are a lot of one-time-only things we buy in the course of a year, but we do generally try to make that link very solidly. And we've discovered over the years that the capital improvement program is a wonderful place to use fund balance for that very issue. The Governmental Accounting Standards Board, who are the ultimate umpires, they're the league office for our accountants, who are our umpires. They recently changed the rules on all the different kinds of fund balance, and so these new definitions that are up here are still, even for us, relatively new. There's committed fund balance, assigned fund balance, and unassigned fund balance. What's important for you guys, I think, in general, are the top one and the bottom one. The committed, if they've been committed, it generally has required a board action to commit the funds, and it requires a board action for funds to be removed from that status. In general, the largest one of those is the county's fiscal reserve. And that's 10% of general and school fund revenues. And at this point in time, that's $126 million. Which seems like an awful lot of money, but you're going to see later that realistically that's only a few weeks of operating revenue for the county. But it's still a very useful cushion to have and is a very important component in the county's bond rating. In economic downturns, or in periods when the county is borrowing a tremendous amount of money, having that fiscal reserve has always been pointed to by the rating agencies and the credit markets as to why Loudoun, you know, is as strong a financial credit as it is. The board has fiscal policies regarding not just the amount and the ability to withdraw money from the fiscal reserve, but also fiscal policies regarding how the board has to establish a plan upon withdrawal of the funds for replenishing the funds. You know, so that if for example, the state were unable to adopt a budget by July 1st and it was delayed until August 1st, we could certainly operate, you know, using the fiscal reserve along with the other revenues that the county generates. But we could certainly help the school system, for example, who are more dependent than we are, operate for that month. But there would have to be a plan for how to return those funds to the fiscal reserve over a period of time. And the very last one, which is the unassigned, which is after everything else has been committed or assigned, which is planned or intended to be used. At the end of the year, there is, you know, every year a positive fund balance, and that positive fund balance is the unassigned and is the amount that is available for reappropriation by the board if they so choose.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. That unassigned, the board can make decisions to do things like buy down debt, fund capital or projects with cash. Can we also carry over?
Yes.
Okay.
In the general fund. Yes.
Yeah, in the general, right. Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're going to talk about next is what we've done with the FY11 fund balance and how the board directed us to allocate that for a lot of it will be available to you as part of your FY13 budget discussions. So we finished FY11 with roughly $100 million or so in terms of a fund balance between us and the schools. That's allocated as you see it on the chart. The first $25.5 million went to retire outstanding debt or buy back existing bonds or debt instruments and pay them off early or defease them. The next $28 million has been set aside for FY13 for the CIP capital contribution, because as in one of the earlier slides, one of the things we try to do is fund at least 10% of your capital budget in cash. And so that's what that's been set aside for FY13. We also funded some of FY12's capital projects out of the FY11 fund balance as opposed to borrowing money for that. We added to the cash contribution in FY12. We set aside $24.6 million for a reserve, and we will talk about this in a few minutes, but whenever you set the tax rate, that tax rate actually affects three different budgets or three different tax collections. I'm sorry. So if you reduce the tax rate in April, that actually has an impact in FY12. And so we'll talk about the current fiscal guidance a little bit tonight, but should one of the options that the staff and I were asked to provide to the board as part of the FY13 budget is a budget that's predicated upon a 5% reduction in the residential homeowner tax bill. If that 5% reduction is realized, that will actually take us below the amount of revenue that needs to be collected to finish the current fiscal year. And so the amount that is has been calculated around $25 million. And so we have set aside a reserve to get through the current fiscal year should you decide to do that. And then we know that there will be an additional payment due on the school side for VRS, which has to do with the state's budget over the last 2 years. And so there's $10 million set aside for in a reserve to help offset or cushion the increase in cost for that item.
Just if I may,
quick question on this. You said the current board adopted this, so this is what we will live with through the remainder of this budget year. Is that correct?
Let me talk about the different components of this and how you're going to see these.
You'll end up allocating it or utilizing it in some manner.
The first item, which is the funding currently outstanding debt, our debt management staff sat down and took a look at currently outstanding debt, which bonds could be called at this point in time. After about 11 or 12 years, you have the ability generally, you don't always build that commodity name, but you generally have the ability to call outstanding bonds. So we looked at those bonds that had a higher than current interest rate on them. And that's set these funds aside to call those bonds. That's $25.5 million. That item will actually be coming to you at your public hearing in January for your decision as to whether to do that. I don't remember off the what the number was off the top of my head, but I think somewhere around $8 million in interest, future interest payments will be saved, along with the principal that would have to be repaid in subsequent years as well. So we looked for the biggest bang for the buck that we could get with those funds over an extended period of time. The third item, which is the CIP capital contribution, again, we looked for those projects that were in the current year's CIP, but also had a short issuance schedule, you know, that again, we thought we could get more bang for the buck by turning into cash rather than debt, by cash financing rather than debt. That, too, will be with you on that same public hearing. They're two item, it's two items together in one budget adjustment. Anything that affects the budget by more than $15 or $16 million by code, we have to have a public hearing for. So that's why it's coming to the board for public hearing. So you'll get a bite at that in January. The $28 million in the capital construction, that is at this point in time almost certainly going to be in the county administrator's proposed budget document. You can do that or not if you are able to reduce the CIP by, say, $80 or $100 million. That would be $8 or $10 million of that you wouldn't have to spend. This is based, the $28 million was based upon our projections from last year's adopted CIP of how much cash would be needed. We used a certain amount last year, but when we looked at what was in the preliminarily approved CIP, you were required another $28 million, so we used fund balance for that. But anything you do that lowers that will free this cash up.
Excuse me 1 minute here. Have you done a trade-off between, money is very cheap right now, cost of capital is cheap, taking tax credits into account, it almost gets down to nothing. Have you done a trade-off between taking on new funding for these capital projects versus and applying that money back towards other older debt that may be not as advantageous?
That's the original 25.3. That's exactly what we did.
Okay.
We're looking at bonds right now that are outstanding between 4.5% to 5.5% interest rate, and the stuff we can get now on 20-year debt's averaging like 2 to 3%. So when we bring you these ideas, we're looking just for that exact situation. Look at what the cost of capital is on our outstanding debt versus cost of capital on new debt. And that's why the $7.4 million, another aspect that Ben didn't really mention, was our cheapest debt we can get is general obligation, voter-approved debt. Some of those other deals are like lease revenue deals, which come with a little bit higher cost of capital. So when we look at retiring or using cash to fund the CIP or pay off debt, we'll take the most expensive debt we have outstanding, and we'll break it down even further and say, what's the next most expensive option for us? What that does to give you all is, obviously it helps on a tax rate and funding for future years, but also increases your debt capacity for future year projects if there's a fire station or school you want to include in there. So we try to do both and also look at the ratios as we go down this whole analysis.
And I guess we have to say, it almost goes without saying that, in general, sometimes you would actually just want to keep the cash and earn interest on it, but quite frankly, right now, the treasurer can't earn any interest. I mean, it's a really minimal amount, unfortunately, despite his best efforts. And the $24.6 million, again, will be set aside. It's, in essence, set aside as a reserve for your use in the FY13 budget process. Well, it's to be used as part of to mitigate the impacts of decisions made in the FY13 budget, and then the $10 million reserve was set aside actually during last year's budget process by the Board of Supervisors to cushion the expected VRS hit. Want to keep going?
I got a question regarding VRS. The governor just announced $2 billion. How does that impact our upcoming budget?
We've preliminarily looked at the numbers, very very preliminarily. Yes, I'd even add more varies to that if I could. Because we really need to see the spreadsheets come from the state, and they haven't yet. It'll be a few more days. We think that the VRS impact for the school system is probably about $30 million compared to FY12. So, but the good news is, you know, we looked at the state, you know, and again, very preliminarily, maybe 15 minutes of total viewing so far today on the full budget that the governor announced today. Should that come to pass, there will probably, hopefully, be additional state revenue, you know, that for the county for a couple of reasons. One, it looks to us like the overall pie increased for state aid. We had a decline in our composite index, which means the states can actually give us a little bit more per child, and we will have more children than last year, or than, you know, anybody else in the state growing. So there is the potential for what's a fairly decent increase in state revenue.
Over and above what we calculated at this point in time?
I think it may be a little more than the schools were counting on, but maybe not enough to – I'm not sure that it – I just don't know. I mean, I really don't know. But I think it's probably more than they were counting on. So I think overall this is better news than it could have been, and it might even be a little better news than we thought it was going to be. But we'll see. It's still very early, and it's got to get adopted by the General Assembly. And, you know, the governor's plans have not always been adopted by the General Assembly.
So very quickly, just in terms of FY12, revenues at this point in time are positive to budget, meaning that we're collecting more revenue than we had projected. And you can see where those areas of growth have been. Our expenditures are on track versus budget. Actually, they're a little bit less than budget. The economic environment, and at least the indicators that we look at, are a little bit mixed, and those numbers are there. Is there anything you guys want to highlight?
The only thing I'd highlight here is certainly one of the, I guess the highlights would be the data center impacts. That impacted both personal property and the computers in the data centers as well as sales tax. So that is one area where we have seen a relatively high uptick in the revenues. So that was worthy of mentioning on there. We did see on the list a little bit of decline in both passenger and cargo activity at the airport, and that's why we're calling the economic environment mixed, although we see the other areas of strength that are showing some signs of recovery, but we don't want to get too excited about it. So that's the only thing I would add to that.
By what percentage have revenues been positive to budget?
I'm sorry, sir.
By what percentage have revenues been positive versus budget?
I think
overall, because you talked about a mixed environment here, so I when I aggregate in, those out, where
I think in general to? We're running about 5%, 5 to 6%. The Commonwealth, the only reason I have that is Commonwealth asked us that in a survey the other day. I think right now, compared to 12, we're running about 5 to 6% up, and we weren't really looking for much growth, if any, this year. So probably net, maybe 3 or 4% above budget. And again, it's almost all concentrated in real property. Things didn't decline as fast as much as we thought they were going to. Personal property, which is the both cars and data centers, and then in sales tax. You know, almost everything else is pretty flat. Building permits are up quite a bit through October. We'll see if that holds on. TOT looks a little weak.
And that's from the hotels.
The hotel. Transient occupancy tax, I'm sorry. Hotel tax. We have a 2% tax that goes into the general fund, and then we have an additional 3% tax on hotel rooms, which goes into the restricted use transient occupancy tax and can be only used for the promotion of business and tourism travel.
This is a chart that just kind of gives a little bit of context to your overall budget. You know, we had talked about the fact that we have roughly $120 million or so that are set aside in your rainy day fund or your reserve, and that is certainly a large number. But when you place it in context, on any given day, the county spends about $4 million on average between the operating and debt service requirements. So that reserve, as large as it is, gives us about, I guess, a little under 30 days of operating. If everything were to continue as normal business, you know, you fund a lot of things. I'm going to run through, because I, just in the interest of time, I'm just going to run through a lot of these slides real quickly, and you can go back and certainly look at them. You know, the county, just on the county government side, the operations that we have are listed there. But when you break up those operations, the majority of where the county effort goes is in public safety. The next largest component is in parks and recreation and culture, and then health and welfare, and then general government, and then community development. And so that's kind of how your current effort in terms of staff is arrayed. Again, this is another way of looking at how your operating local tax funding, where that goes to. And this is just a different way of presenting the same functions in a little different manner. To talk about the FY13 budget process, we have already begun our kickoff. We start that typically in the September timeframe. At this point in time, we have a lot of the information that's on this chart back. We start in September. We end up with, we send out a request to the towns as well as the regional organizations that we fund, ask them to provide us with any requests that they may have so that can be considered by staff and then presented to you with a recommendation. There is a revenue committee that is made up of a number of different departments that looks at the projections that go into the actual budget process. And then we also ask the board for fiscal guidance in the September-October timeframe. I want to go to the next slide, which is kind of the timeline and the chart, which is kind of laid out there for you. One of the there's a couple of things on the chart that are in a red color. One of the things that we have been doing is coming back to the board in January to ask you to comment on the fiscal guidance. I mean, we typically, in a normal process, come in the September-October timeframe, ask for general guidance as to where you want us to be for the next year's budget. We come back to you in December with an item on fund balance and talk about general fiscal health. But then typically in January, we come back again to say, okay, this is where we are vis-a-vis the fiscal guidance that was given. The importance of that last check-in is really talks about where do you want the advertised tax rate to be, because that will go out as an advertisement with the proposed budget document, which I'll be presenting to you, as Chairman York had indicated, on February 7th at 5 p.m. So that is, we'll be back on January 3rd to ask where you want us to be. We'll give you a presentation as to where we are with the budget presentation, but that is your real final opportunity to weigh in on that before you get the proposed budget and the advertised tax rate in early February. The reason why I emphasize that is because once the advertised tax rate goes out, if you want to adopt a tax rate above that, you have to re-advertise. Mm-hmm. And given your calendar, it's very difficult to do that. So usually we try to put a tax rate out there for you that is most likely higher than what you're going to consider. But the reason for that is to provide you options, primarily on the school side.
Quick question. Couple parts. First, what is the current guidance that has been given to the department heads of how to put forward their budget, and has also guidance been given across the schools, or are you talking only on the county government side? And secondly, have you all done a calculation yet as what would be the equalized tax rate?
Okay.
Flip forward two
if
slides.
If you want to flip forward two slides. This is the fiscal guidance that has been given by the current board, and so that's to come back with a budget that has a 0% with options that have a zero that include a 0% increase in the residential homeowners equalized rate, or the 0% increase in the average homeowner's tax bill, a 5% increase in the average homeowner's tax bill, or a 5% decrease in the average homeowner's tax bill. And along with that, to maintain the current split of 66% going to the schools and 34% remaining with the county government or the general government.
And that 66%, 34% split is including operations and capital.
What that means is we've translated that into where we think we can, where we will be on the county side, and ask the departments to prepare their budgets, assuming, for the most part, a maintenance budget at the 0% option. There are some enhancements proposed at that level, as well as certainly above that level. But we are looking at several reduction options to get us to the 5% decrease within the 34% split and on for the 5% decrease option on the average homeowner's tax bill. So there will be some proposals that come forward for reductions in certain areas.
Yeah, but that reduction is only in the general fund, not the schools.
No, that affects both the schools as well as the county general government. How that translates is those numbers, based off of where we were in the October-November timeframe, came out to a certain projection for the local fund transfer that goes to the schools. And so I have sent a letter to Dr. Hattrick indicating to him what the local fund transfer will be from the Board of Supervisors to the schools based off of those scenarios. So
can we see that letter?
We'll give you a copy of the letter. If we didn't include it in the 19th packet, we'll get you a copy of it, because that is copied to the board. So we have definitely sent that letter and transmitted it to the schools. It applies to both the schools as well as the general county government. So based off of our revenue projections, that tells us the amount of money we're working with, and based on the split, that gives a definitive number at each of those three levels.
We have run this scenario the last couple of years. This is not the first time we've done it exactly this way. And for general information, the schools have generally complied with at least providing a scenario, you know, that complied with that initial direction.
Can you talk the timing of when we'll see the schools operating the capital budgets?
There is a schedule in here. I thought we had it on the global calendar. Okay, it's not on here. What I know is that, well, Dr. Hattrick intends to provide his operating proposed budget the first week of January.
Yes.
They are intending or scheduled to adopt their budget the last week of January, is my understanding, and then they'll adopt their capital budget second week of February.
Right, Valentine's Day. So,
well, the schools could traditionally consider and adopt their budget before it comes to you, which is really their request to you. You kind of need to know what they're thinking, because that affects your local fund transfer, because a good portion of their budget and their operations are funded locally. So you need to have that input from them in order to consider what you're going to do.
That means that for us to give any kind of have any discussion with the school board, it's going to have to be pretty quickly for them to get an idea of what we'd be interested in. Okay. It also means that the idea of a two-year budget is probably not going to happen, right?
Well, they need to be able to consider, I mean, the way the process is set up is because we come and get we have fiscal guidance from the board, which is essentially an indication of where you want to be or what your range is for consideration. What that does is it kind of tells the school superintendent and the school board what their range is, because they know more or less, they can get a pretty good projection on what their state revenue is going to be. And the two largest components of their budget is what they get from the Commonwealth and what they get from us. There's about $30 million or so in federal funding, more or less, but that varies from year to year. So they need to kind of know where you are, and that happens through the fiscal guidance process. But they have to take the first crack, I think, at what they want or how they want to spend or put together their needs to present to you for consideration. You do get into a pretty significant, traditionally, I don't know how this board will treat it, but traditionally the board does get into a pretty significant discussion with the school board once you have their budget request before you, okay, and once you have my proposed budget before you.
Okay, so we'll have a so there's an opportunity for them to come back in February or March and make changes if they want to.
Yeah, okay, which is why we typically will advertise a rate higher. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say typically, and they're kind of in a different process this year with Hatcher coming out in January because they normally, I think he comes out in November.
They come earlier.
Yeah. And so we're in a kind of time crunch. But generally, once they introduce the budget, a county administrator will advertise it along with his budget to us, and then we typically will set up a meeting with the board to kind of go over their budget and for them to present why they're suggesting to us the expenditure. And then behind the scenes out in public, we have the debate. We will set the amount that they get as a board and final adoption, and then they have to go back generally and after we have adopted the budget, and then they will adjust accordingly to what we have given them, which is typically not 100% of what they've requested.
In general, there are three documents that you'll get from the school board over the course of the year, you know, and this is true for both the operating budget and the capital budget. You get the county, you get the superintendent's proposed budget, and that's what will come out the first week in January. Then you'll get the school board's adopted budget, which doesn't mean what we think that means, and that's simply their recommendation to you all. And that'll come out, you know, hopefully by the end of January, but prior to your deliberations really beginning. Then after you all have adopted your budget and your tax rates, they produce a document that they call the appropriated budget. And that's their final document that will reflect all of the changes that they've made based upon the other two budgets and the amount of money you finally gave them.
That'll be in May.
Generally, they've generally produced that by sometime in May.
It usually comes out in May because they have to send out contracts.
Yeah, right.
And their contracts have to be done by June 1st, I believe, for their teachers. So
they really aim to be done by May 1st, though, because there's a certain amount of sniping of each other's staff that will happen if it gets out any later than May 1st.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just a question. Do we know why they're waiting until January before they present the budget? I'm just curious because I remember being on the school board. That was always in November, and even when the transition was taking place, it was right after the election almost.
Well, the last time they tried to do some transition, I don't remember which one now, unfortunately, they attempted to have the incoming school board members set with the existing school board members.
That's what we did.
And go over the budget. And I guess it was felt by whoever makes those decisions over there that was not a successful endeavor.
Must mean they didn't get what they were looking for.
You know, in recent years, there's been a feeling by the school board that by having a budget that's presented later, that somehow allows more deliberation. It allows more deliberation with some informal input from the Board of Supervisors as they're going through their process. I don't know how realistic that is.
It just seems to me that it's a whole month of time lost where you could be familiarizing yourself with the budget and what you're up against.
Maybe that's what they don't want.
Okay. Just, and I know I'm trying to be sensitive to the time, but the one thing you'll vote on is part of the budget will be the tax rate. There's a very quick explanation of the tax rate versus the tax bill. Obviously, the tax bill is a combination of the tax rate multiplied against the assessed value. Assessments are done as of January 1st. every year. The assessor will be, I believe, delivers those bills sometime in late January, or actually the assessments will go out in late January. And then that is the actual base against which you will apply a tax rate. Do you want to elaborate on that at all, guys?
The only other thing is an answer to Ms. Volpe's question earlier about the potential tax rate at 0%. You know, at this point, it's still early to tell. The assessor is working as diligently as he can to get everything crammed into the system so that everything's effective as of January 1st. So we won't have final numbers from him till probably the second or third week in January. And they're obviously going to be very important because that revaluation number is a very important one. But in everything we've seen from him preliminarily so far, there's not a huge movement in revaluations in the county, you know, on an average basis. Again, individual results will vary. I've got to warn everybody about that. But, you know, from the information we've seen from him so far, the zero could be $1.28.5, the current rate. It could be a little bit higher than that, 1 or 2% higher than that. It could be 1 or 2% lower than that. But it's probably not going to vary out of that range too dramatically unless something else happens in the next couple of weeks. But that's, you know, still early to tell. It's just still early to tell.
I think we're planning on having him come to us in the second meeting of January, so to give us a briefing.
I'm going to try to explain this, and then depending on how well I do, I'm going to ask Mark and Ben to also explain this. But when you set a tax rate, the tax year runs from January 1 through December 31st of the year. So tax year 2012 runs from January 1 through December 31st of 2012. Your fiscal year runs from July 1st of one year through June 30th of the following year. So because of, and then we also collect taxes twice a year. There's a tax collection that occurs in June, and there's a tax collection that occurs in October or December. I get personal property sometimes, but it's June and December. So when you set your tax rate, you're actually affecting two budgets, okay? Because if you set your tax rate in April, that will affect the second half of FY12, even though it's for tax year 12. If you have a higher tax rate, that actually results in a bump because we'll actually collect more revenue in fiscal year 12 than we had anticipated because of an increased tax rate for the second half of the year. Similarly, if you lower the tax rate in FY12 for the FY13 budget, you will decrease collections for the FY12 budget, which ties back to the reserve that we set aside in the event that you do that or anticipated that you may do that. And then that tax rate will carry through or will be utilized for a funding level for FY13. So we call that the spring bump. Sometimes it gets a little tricky to explain and follow through on. I tried to explain it. I don't know if
you did a very good job. That's what we tried to build a calendar to show you how it works. We think sometimes that's a little easier than hearing it. But basically, Mr. Hemster is correct. When you set your tax rate in April, you are affecting three different collections. You'll affect the one that happens in fiscal year 12, and then the two that happen in fiscal year 13. So whatever happens with the tax rate, there is a current year impact. So if you recall back on the fund balance slide, we set aside $24.8 million because if we end up near the negative 5%, we would have to have some money to finish out this year. Because another important aspect of that is the guidance is a negative 5%, but the Board of Supervisors has already allocated the school resources their money. So really, we can't go back to the schools and get money. So that actually negative hit would be all on the county side.
Right, because once you appropriate, you write the check, and it's done for that fiscal year.
So, and if you adopt in April and the tax rate's lower, that really only gives us a few months to recoup that money. So we had to set aside something in that planning stage. If the board ends up at a 0% area, there's an additional fund balance to use for other projects.
Right. Now, the other reason why we explain this is because the other question we almost get, we always get, is what is the value of a penny on the tax rate? Okay, so your total portfolio is about $54 billion. So in the current year, two tax collections, one penny is about $5.5 million. But because of the bump, you're actually considering that penny against three tax collections. So we often refer to one penny being about $8.2 million. So that's the other reason, but that's...
No, just the question. I've always understood it. A new penny is worth eight.
Yes.
An old penny is worth five.
Correct. Right. That's okay. because of that. Well, it's 5.5 for an old penny, but it's because of that. Just very quickly, some of the issues that are considered, that are continuing to be out there that will affect the FY13 budget is compensation and benefit-related increases. We talked about one of those, the largest being VRS. But health coverage and those kinds of things are something to consider, as well as any type of salary adjustments that the board wants to consider. School funding needs are out there. Mr. Mays talked about the fact that we're really the balancer on the school's budget because it starts with whatever the Commonwealth is going to do, which starts with the governor's budget that was presented today, and then we'll follow through through General Assembly consideration. Keep in mind that the school's increased by about 3,000 students every year, which has some level of additional costs that comes with that. We have tried to apply the one-time fund balance from FY11 to buy down one-time revenues, primarily in capital or outstanding debt. There is also new facilities that will finish the construction process on the county side that there will have to be a decision made by you all in April as to whether or not you want to fund the opening of those facilities. Right now, those are slated to be the Western Sheriff Substation and the Gumspring Library. I do think we should talk about capital very quickly because that is a separate process. You will spend a lot of time on the capital budget.
I'm going to turn it over here to Paul and Dan to run through it very quickly. But one of the things I just want to say is that, of course, the capital plan is our volume two of the two large books that you get every year. The capital improvement plan is a component of a long-term plan that includes a comprehensive process that we go through on a regular basis. And we deal with all the policy that is set by the board. We deal with the program, the needs of the programs, and what you're going to see, what comes out of this is a huge competing need issue, not just internally with the county's transportation, public safety, but also it does include the school component. So every year what we try to do is put together what we feel is a competent, reasonable plan that respects all of the county's, the Board of Supervisors' policies, as well as trying to satisfy as much of the need as we can for the program and the constituents of the county. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Paul and let Paul and Dan run through some of the specifics.
Okay, I'd like to introduce Dan Sizemore, who is our capital budget manager, and he's going to talk about real quickly this first slide about the linkage between the board's comprehensive plan and its capital planning.
Yeah, the basis of our capital facility planning process comes from the revised general plan, chapters 2, 3, and 11. In a nutshell, it calls for service plans, and the capital component of our service plans are what we call capital facility standards. If you look at this handout that we passed out, it has our contact information on the front page. If you turn the page, these are the actual adopted capital facility standards in effect right now. So as you can see, these are the facilities that our departments have stated that they want to build. And it also sets up population triggers or thresholds at which they should be developed. So if you look at fire station, for example, there's two different standards. Each station is about 13,000 square feet, up to 5 acres, and that takes into consideration that there's parking requirements, zoning setback requirements, stormwater management requirements. That's the purpose of an up to 5 acre site. And then you have population triggers at which they should be developed. So in the east, it's one per 25,000 residents where you have a higher density. Where you have a lower density in the west, it's one per 10,000. And that kind of takes into account response times.
Excuse me, may I ask you a question in relation to that? Not so much the fire station, but if you jump down to where the sheriff substation is listed,
mm-hmm.
one for every 75,000 in population, you know, our recent redistricting was based on approximately 40,000 people per district. So, for example, in the west or in the Blue Ridge District, because really Catoctin is a western district too, but in the Blue Ridge District, being based on approximately 40,000 people, but yet there's a slated western sheriff substation based on 75,000.
Those standards were adopted in 2010. Your redistricting took place after that. We'll explain how, during your term, these standards will come back to you for discussion. So the planning for that Western Loudoun substation was based on the board's current policy at that time. And also, that particular station was based on the fact that the current leased facility was inadequate and was not meeting ADA. So not only was there a standard problem, there was a service problem that went into the decision of a station being funded in the west and the location that it went into. But you will inherit a CIP that is based on the prior board's capital facility standards that were adopted, and then during your term, you'll have a chance to review those and make a decision whether you want to continue them, modify them, or amend them.
Okay, then, Paul, could we get a copy of those current standards since, you know, the project?
These are the current standards.
These are the ones moving forward, but the prior standards.
This is the one the current plans are based on. There has not been a change of the population thresholds in these standards based on your redistricting of the population in your districts.
Right, but for example, with respect to, say, the Western Sheriff's, Western Loudoun substation, that's based off of the two Western districts, and so there is the population that would trigger the need for the substation, which is why it gets proposed. Now it's up to the board as to whether or not you actually want to move forward with that. But that is the document that kind of guides us in terms of when we bring facilities to the Board of Supervisors for your consideration.
Okay, well, we can talk about this more later, but the two prior districts were based on some 22,000 plus each.
Correct.
And still, collectively, that doesn't meet the 75,000, but we'll talk about this later.
I would suggest
it's based
we
off a
meeting.
Well, it's based off a population. I just want to make a comment in terms of the when you do your magisterial districts, that's based off of the population of the county in every 10 years. So that last redistricting process was based off based on the population in the year 2000. We annually, those population figures are revised both through the American Community Survey as well as by the staff in Management Financial Services that do those projections for you. The capital facility standards are based off of those population projections and not off of the magisterial districts that are the basis by which your district boundaries are defined. So, for example, your district boundaries were defined in 2010 based off of an overall population of 312,000 and 311 or something like that, and then split up, which comes out to about 38,000 people or so per district. But the current population in 2011 is actually estimated to be closer to 317,000 or in change, and then your population in 2012 will be over 320,000. So you're continuing to add people. These capital facility standards are based off of the total population projections on an annual basis. But
one of the things to remember is, as well as I think what Paul was trying to get at, is capital facility standards are the capital facility standards are one of the major drivers for new projects getting in the CIP. But they are not the only driver for that. You know, there was a small existing, really small sheriff place in Western Loudoun. The sheriff's Western substation kind of replaced that rather than necessarily being entirely driven by the capital facility standards at the time. So, you know, in general, we try to follow this. We really try to be as close to the board's policies as we can. But from time to time, political and other programmatic decisions do enter into the process.
Okay. Ben, I understand. We need to move on from this because this is a bigger discussion. So let's move on.
I just have one quick question, though. When you do define something such as the West for the purpose of the capital facility standard, are you using the planning sub-areas?
Yes.
Not the magisterial districts?
Correct.
So, for instance, you have one community that's in three different planning sub-areas, and that might, like Brambleton, that might explain why.
Well, but that's the whole thing, is now, today, there is a station going in there.
Right.
So.
Right. But that isn't considered the West for the purposes of this.
Right.
Because it's a different planning sub-area. I see.
We need to discuss this more later.
One really easy, quick question on this. You've also got the capital facility standards for the schools at the bottom of your handout. Is that driven by the school board or by the Board of Supervisors?
Well, that's driven by the school board having a discussion of their models of the schools they want to deliver.
I wanted to clarify. Okay.
During the last board terms, there was a joint school board and Board of Supervisors committee that actually adopted a capital facilities guideline for the planning purposes, and that document's available online. And if you would like to get copies of it, we can make sure that you get them. Okay.
Could all these documents be added to the website? I didn't see it there because either my iPad's not working. Or I didn't look in the right place, but if you could put that under the special meetings, not the phone numbers, of course, but the documents, the handout for the special, the handout. And there was a reference to a document on the 19th. Was that a reference to today, earlier? In other words, the budget?
No. Supervisor Delgadio, my reference was to November 19th when we handed out a number of documents as part of that orientation session.
Right, there were a lot of attachments in that, and that's the last thing that shows on the website, the 19th. And then, of course, there were the special meetings on the 1st and the 3rd of December.
And then we'll get these up on there as well.
Okay. Yellow doesn't show up so good on the television, so please don't use yellow, I was told.
The capital facility standards are reviewed by the Fiscal Impact Committee, the Finance Committee, and then approved by the board. So it goes through three layers of review before they're actually adopted. Once adopted, we take the capital facility standards and population projections, and we produce the adopted capital needs assessment. If you haven't received a copy of this, let me know. You should have received a copy of this document. If not, just give me a call. What this does is it basically is a mathematical exercise where it projects out, based on the facility standards and the anticipated population growth, what facilities need to be developed over a 10-year period beyond the adopted CIP. So when we did this latest version of the adopted capital needs assessment, the CIP was FY 11 to 16. So this CNA document goes through 2017 to 2026. It's not a financial document. It's a planning document. So there aren't any numbers associated with these projects. It's just kind of taking a snapshot of what is expected to be developed if we stayed true to the adopted facility standards based on future population projections. From there, we have our capital improvement program, or our CIP. It's a six-year document. This next one, obviously, is FY 13 to 18. The first year of the CIP is what you're considering for appropriations. The rest of the projects that are anticipated from 14 to 18, the funding that are placed into those years are kind of placeholders. When we get into the FY 14 budget, the CIP will be from FY 14 through FY 18. So it goes from a six-year CIP. You don't add another year at that point because it's a biennial process. So you're going from 14 to 18 in FY14, and then you're considering appropriations for FY14. Then when we go to the FY15 budget, it'll be 15 to 20. You're adding in FY19 and FY20. Typically, projects need to be considered in the CNA to be placed in the CIP. So as you notice, when you go from the FY11 to 16 CIP, in 17 and 18, a lot of the projects that you'll see when the CIP gets proposed to you come from this document. They're first considered in here, and then we go through the exercise of what is affordable based on our financial policies. So this allows us the opportunity to link our comprehensive plan to our actual fiscal planning policies in our capital program. I'm going to turn it over to Paul now, who's going to explain the CIP in relation to the public schools.
Before I get into the schools, I do want to add that the Planning Commission is actively involved in the capital needs assessment process. They review all the assumptions of these facilities in the planning sub-areas. They will actually form a recommendation to you as the board. Then you as the board will have a public hearing, let the public be invested in looking at what's coming into their sub-areas, and then adopt it. And then, as Dan said, it's a critical document for what should come forward for consideration for funding. Traditionally, as Ben mentioned earlier, the superintendent proposes a capital plan that proposes the mixture of school facilities that need to be built over the six-year planning period. The school board reviews that. They make their adjustments, and they adopt a plan. And then it is forwarded to you for consideration. The challenges with this year are the fact that they're not planning to adopt it till February 14th. We will have a lot of missing data until their document is actually adopted and forwarded to you. In the proposed, we will be carrying forward the projects that were adopted by the prior board from FY11 through 16. In this case, you'll see the 13 through the 16 projects. 17 and 18, we're working with the county administrator, who is in consultation with the superintendent of how they want to handle those years, given that we will not have their adopted document until after the county administrator has proposed the budget. The biggest challenges in working with the schools is historically they present a needs-based capital improvement program based on where they see their student enrollments. That needs-based CIP, as it's referred to, often is requesting more funding than the fiscal policies can sustain, either from a debt perspective or from a cash perspective in a given year. As an example, you will be early on into the discussion because in FY13, the appropriation year, currently there are $239 million worth of school projects proposed, so that requires a match of $23 million in local tax funding, and generally the balance of that would be on a fall referendum for general obligation bond financing or through Virginia Public School Authority. So the process usually starts, and I don't know your committee structure yet, but the Finance Committee usually takes the first review of both the county and general government projects. They make a recommendation to the full board. You have work sessions with the school board on their capital plan, as well as the general government plan. And somewhere between March and the 1st of April, decisions are made on what you actually want to fund within the tax rate that's before you for fiscal year 13. Basically a liaison role, our capital budget office. We work closely with the school staff who transmit the information to us, and we try to get it to you in a timely manner. And then if you have questions about the capital budget, it's usually coordinated through the regular budget question response through a budget officer, and we make sure we try to get you the answers as quickly as possible to assist you in your deliberations. And that's the process.
Just very quickly to kind of wrap up, the FY13 budget is kind of put together around these themes. The highest priority, the first priority, is to try to maintain and enhance our public safety and human services safety nets. So you'll see an emphasis in those areas. Any board initiatives that come forward, which includes economic development, we will, you know, do what we can to balance our core infrastructure, and also, like I said, our proposed budget will always try or will be a structurally balanced budget, recurring expenditures to recurring revenues. just to kind of close, going to the last slide, the next step in the process is we'll come back on January 3rd with a report as to where we are financially. We'll have analyzed the governor's proposed budget by that time. We'll report to you what those impacts are. We will explain again in more detail the fiscal guidance that was given by the current board in last September, October. We will ask you, or I will ask you, if you want to affirm that guidance or if you want to give us different guidance. And then the financial impacts that are associated with that will be presented on the 3rd, to the extent that we know them. The assessor's property assessments will come out sometime after that, so we will not have the final numbers in time for that final fiscal guidance from the board in January. If you follow the traditional process or how the schedule has traditionally laid out, I will give you a proposed budget, which includes all the elements that we talked about today on February 7th, the second Tuesday of the month, just prior to your public hearing date at 5 p.m. Traditionally, the board then, that document is printed and it's provided to the public via the website, and it's available here as well as at the libraries for the public to review. Typically what happens is in the last week or two of February, the last full week of February, I suppose, we'll schedule public hearings for you. Usually that takes place on a Wednesday afternoon, usually around 3 or 3:30, and then again at 6:30 on a Wednesday. And if you have carryover, that will go to the following Thursday or the next day. So Wednesday, 3:30, 6:30, and then Thursday, the next day at 6:30, if you have remaining speakers to comment on the budget to give you input. And then there is traditionally a Saturday session that typically runs from about 9 or 9:30 on Saturday until it ends, and that's typically at the school's administration building in their boardroom. Following that, beginning in March, the board traditionally meets 2 to 3 nights or days a week throughout the month of March. We work with the chairman and the vice chairman to go ahead and schedule those. Those typically run 2 to 3 hours, starting at about 6 o'clock. We typically try to start around 6, and then those, you'll review each of the departments on those nights. So we'll work with the chairman and the vice chairman to put that schedule together. There are typically 2 and possibly 3 Saturday sessions that are scheduled as part of that effort, with the intent being the board being in a position to adopt the budget and a final tax rate for your first meeting in April. And then July 1st, your new fiscal year begins. And so that's kind of your next steps.
Let me just add that when you get the calendar for March, it's going to be very, very loaded with nights and days. Typically, when we get into about the second week to see where we are, we'll revise it, and you'll typically find that near the end, a lot of those days start falling off the calendar because they're not simply needed. But given that most of you, this is your first budget, we're going to schedule quite a few evenings and just see how it goes. But it is it's March Madness, not just because of basketball, I will tell you that. And I can tell you that about 2 weeks into it, you're going to be tired, you're going to be frustrated, and you just do what you can do to get through it. But that is the process. Yeah, well, typically we have invited the schools the first session to come in and present their budget to give us an opportunity to, again, to talk offline with them and to have the opportunity to review their presentation. Sometimes we'll have them back for a second session There have been times that we haven't. We just wait until we adopt the final number that we send, that we will transmit over to them. But that will be a decision of the board. But hopefully, I think probably by the first week of January, we should have a preliminary calendar to pass out for March, because people have to adjust their schedules accordingly.
And then also, in addition to that, the Finance Committee, you'll start the review of the capital budget. And traditionally, you'll start the reviewing the capital budget in February. And so you'll have usually, I want to say, two meetings at least prior to the March, start of the March, because you're making a recommendation to the full board as to what you want to do with capital.
Yeah, you might have a couple of meetings a month for February and March timeframe, so be prepared for that. Ken?
Yes, it's primarily because of that kind of regimen, and just from a planning standpoint, and what we've done in Leesburg, that I would like a two-year budget. But I have to ask you, Tim, is that possible for you to do? If we gave guidance to you in January, and is it possible for the school board to do it? I'm asking Tim.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's been tried here. Ben is probably in the best position to talk about that. You know, the challenge with a 2-year budget for the board is the fact that you're growing so quickly, and you're going to continue to have, you know, additional challenges that are presented to you because of that growth. You know, you could certainly set targets, I suppose, but, you know, in any given year, you're going to have additional commercial and residential projects coming online.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. How about this? Since I know everybody has stuff and this was supposed to be short, how about you guys maybe put your thinking caps on over the next 6 to 8 months and see what the feasibility in the future would be for doing a 2-year budget?
The one alternative I would give you to that is that you know, yes, we've done it, and, you know, there are pros and cons. Another way to do this is what Chesterfield County does. Chesterfield County does a rolling 2-year budget, and there are a lot of advantages to that.
And you could do that.
And that's
so you're adopting, and then you have like a projected – the
right
targets that you want to get to. I mean,
I think that'd be hard to do at this point in time.
I think this is a discussion for another time. This board has some other initiatives that may affect the ability to do biennium budgets or rolling budgets. They're both best practices in corporations and so forth, but I think this requires a conversation of some of the other initiatives and how they would affect that going forward.
All right. Any other items? Ken?
You were saying that your fiscal policies are not to capitalize expenditures, but early in the year, I don't know whether it was from my discussion with you or from someone else, that you have been capitalizing salaries in the construction management area? There was some decision that was made years ago?
We actually, what we do is the Office of Capital Construction. The school system capitalizes all of their project management staff. The county is not a regular enough borrower for bond money for that to be as feasible for us as it has been for the school system. But we know that over time that may well change. So what we started doing, I guess about 5 years ago now, was putting the costs of the Office of Construction Management in the capital budget. So there's actually a local tax funding transfer to the capital projects fund to pay for those operations, and then so while they're in the CIP, they're locally tax funded. Right. So, and they're also, but our goal in the long run would be, as there are bond financed projects, it's appropriate for, you know, say you were to go and do another large courthouse project of, say, $40 million, and you had a couple of project managers working on that, it's perfectly appropriate for those project managers to be charged to that project during the life of the project. But right now, we're not still really at that stage of development yet. You know, if we wind up getting devolution or something like that, we may well be. But just in case, we're just setting stuff up for that regard. And that helps us also achieve some of our 10% cash in the CIP process as well.
Just a couple of cleanup items. There's some forms that you need to sign as a duplicate copy of the oath of office. Sign them and give them back to Jeanette Newton, and she will get them to Gary, who will sign his signature on it, and you'll get an original back. Huh? Yeah, check spelling your name, because we've had one. All right, we'll just go ahead and correct it, and we'll make sure. And then conflict of interest forms, folks, need to be taken care of, I think, by the 15th of January, same time frame as the financial disclosure forms for your campaigns. So that, there's nothing else. We're adjourned for the evening. Yeah.